The Word of Unbinding.
The two stories that follow were my first approach to, and exploration of, the secondary world of Earthsea, about which I later wrote three novels. I didn't know much about the place at first, and readers familiar with the trilogy will notice that trolls became extinct in Earthsea at some point, and that the history of the dragon Yavad is somewhat obscure. He must have been on Satin's Island some decades or centuries before Ged found him, and bound him, on the Isle of Pendor. But this is only to be expected of dragons, who do not submit to the unidirectional, causal requirements of history, being myths, and neither time-binding nor time-bound. The rule of names first explores an essential element of how magic works in Earthsea. The Word of Unbinding foreshadows the end of the last book of the trilogy, The Farthest Shore, in its imagery of the world of the dead. It also reveals a certain obsession with trees, which, once you notice them, keep cropping up throughout my work. I think I am definitely the most arboreal science fiction writer. It's all right for the rest of you who climbed down and developed opposable thumbs and erect posture and all that. There's a few of us still up here swinging.
Where was he? The floor was hard and slimy. The air black and stinking. And that was all there was, except a headache. Lying flat on the clammy floor, Festin moaned, and then said, "Staff!" When his Alderwood wizard staff did not come to his hand, he knew he was in peril. He sat up, and not having his staff with which to make a proper light, he struck a spark between finger and thumb, muttering a certain word. A blue will-o'-the-wisp sprang from the spark and rolled feebly through the air, sputtering. "Up," said Festin, and the fireball wobbled upward till it lit a vaulted trapdoor very high above. So high that Festin, projecting into the fireball momentarily, saw his own face 40 feet below as a pale dot in the darkness. The light struck no reflections in the damp walls. They had been woven out of night, by magic. He rejoined himself and said, "Out!" The ball expired. Festin sat in the dark, cracking his knuckles. He must have been overspelled from behind by surprise, for the last memory he had was of walking through his own woods at evening, talking with the trees. Lately, in these lone years in the middle of his life, he had been burdened with a sense of waste, of unspent strength. So, needing to learn patience, he had left the villages and gone to converse with trees, especially oaks, chestnuts, and the grey alders, whose roots are in profound communication with running water. It had been 6 months since he had spoken to a human being. He had been busy with essentials, casting no spells and bothering no one. So who had spellbound him and shut him in this reeking well? "Who?" he demanded of the walls, and slowly a name gathered on them and ran down to him like a thick black drop sweated out from pores of stone and spores of fungus. Vol. For a moment Festin was in a cold sweat himself. He had heard first long ago of Vol the Fell, who was said to be more than wizard yet less than man, who passed from island to island of the Outer Reach, undoing the works of the ancients, enslaving men, cutting forests and spoiling fields, and sealing in underground tombs any wizard or mage who tried to combat him. Refugees from ruined islands told always the same tale, that he came at evening on a dark wind over the sea. His slaves followed in ships. These they had seen, but none of them had ever seen Vol. There were many men and creatures of evil will among the islands, and Festin, a young warlock intent on his training, had not paid much heed to these tales of Vol the Fell. "I can protect this island," he had thought, knowing his untried power, and had returned to his oaks and alders, the sound of wind in their leaves, the rhythm of growth in their round trunks and limbs and twigs. the taste of sunlight on leaves or dark groundwater around roots. Where were they now, the trees, his old companions? Had Vol destroyed the forest? Awake at last and up on his feet, Festin made two broad motions with rigid hands, shouting aloud a name that would burst all locks and break open any man-made door. But these walls impregnated with night and the name of their builder did not heed, did not hear. The name re-echoed back, clapping in Festin's ears so that he fell on his knees, hiding his head in his arms till the echoes died away in the vaults above him. Then, still shaken by the backfire, he sat, brooding. They were right. Vol was strong. Here on his own ground, within this spell-built dungeon, his magic would withstand any direct attack. And Festin's strength was halved by the loss of his staff. But not even his captor could take from him his powers, relative only to himself, of projecting and transforming. So, after rubbing his now doubly aching head, he transformed. Quietly, his body melted away into a cloud of fine mist. Lazy, trailing, the mist rose off the floor, drifting up along the slimy walls until it found, where vault met wall, a hairline crack. Through this, droplet by droplet, it seeped. It was almost all through the crack when a hot wind, hot as a furnace blast, struck at it, scattering the mist drops, drying them. Hurriedly, the mist sucked itself back into the vault, spiraled to the floor, took on Festin's own form, and lay there, panting. Transformation is an emotional strain to introverted warlocks of Festin's sort. When to that strain is added the shock of facing unhuman death in one's assumed shape, the experience becomes horrible. Festin lay for a while merely breathing. He was also angry with himself. It had been a pretty simple-minded notion to escape as a mist, after all. Every fool knew that trick. Vol had probably just left a hot wind waiting. Festin gathered himself into a small black bat, flew up to the ceiling, re-transformed into a thin stream of plain air, and seeped through the crack. This time he got clear out, and was blowing softly down the hall in which he found himself towards a window, when a sharp sense of peril made him pull together, snapping himself into the first small, coherent shape that came to mind, a gold ring. It was just as well. The hurricane of arctic air that would have dispersed his air form in unrecallable chaos merely chilled his ring form slightly. As the storm passed, he lay on the marble pavement, wondering which form might get out the window quickest. Too late, he began to roll away. An enormous, blank-faced troll strode cataclysmically across the floor, stopped, caught the quick-rolling ring, and picked it up in a huge limestone-like hand. The troll strode to the trapdoor, lifted it by an iron handle and a muttered charm, and dropped Festin down into the darkness. He fell straight for 40 feet and landed on the stone floor. Clink. Resuming his true form, he sat up, ruefully rubbing a bruised elbow. Enough of this transformation on an empty stomach. He longed bitterly for his staff, with which he could have summoned up any amount of dinner. Without it, though he could change his own form and exert certain spells and powers, he could not transform or summon to him any material thing, neither lightning nor a lamb chop. Patience, Festin told himself. And when he had got his breath, he dissolved his body into the infinite delicacy of volatile oils, becoming the aroma of a frying lamb chop. He drifted once more through the crack. The waiting trolls sniffed suspiciously, but already Festin had regrouped himself into a falcon, winging straight for the window. The troll lunged after him, missed by yards, and bellowed in a vast stony voice, "The hawk! Get the hawk!" Swooping over the enchanted castle towards his forest, that lay dark to westward, sunlight and sea glare dazzling his eyes, Festin rode the wind like an arrow, but a quicker arrow found him. Crying out, he fell. Sun and sea and towers spun around him and went out. He woke again on the dank floor of the dungeon, hands and hair and lips wet with his own blood. The arrow had struck his pinion as a falcon, his shoulder as a man. Lying still, he mumbled a spell to close the wound. Presently, he was able to sit up and recollect a longer, deeper spell of healing. But he had lost a good deal of blood, and with it, power. A chill had settled in the marrow of his bones, which even the healing spell could not warm. There was darkness in his eyes, even when he struck a will-o'-the-wisp and lit the reeking air. The same dark mist he had seen as he flew, overhanging his forest and the little towns of his land. It was up to him to protect that land. He could not attempt direct escape again. He was too weak and tired. Trusting his power too much, he had lost his strength. Now, whatever shape he took would share his weakness and be trapped. Shivering with cold, he crouched there, letting the fireballs sputter out with a last whiff of methane, marsh gas. The smell brought to his mind's eye the marshes stretching from the forest wall down to the sea. His beloved marshes where no men came, where in fall the swans flew long and level, where between still pools and reed islands the quick, silent seaward streamlets ran. Oh, to be a fish in one of those streams. Or better yet, to be farther upstream, near the springs, in the forest, in the shadow of the trees, in the clear brown backwater under an alder's roots, resting hidden. This was a great magic. Festin had no more performed it than has any man who, in exile or danger, longs for the earth and waters of his home, seeing and yearning over the doorsill of his house, the table where he has eaten, the branches outside the window of the room where he has slept. Only in dreams do any but the great mages realize this magic of going home. But Festin, with the cold creeping out from his marrow into nerves and veins, stood up between the black walls, gathered his will together till it shone like a candle in the darkness of his flesh, and began to work the great and silent magic. The walls were gone. He was in the earth, rocks and veins of granite for bones, groundwater for blood, the roots of things for nerves. Like a blind worm, he moved through the earth westward, slowly, darkness before and behind. Then, all at once, coolness flowed along his back and belly, a buoyant, unresisting, inexhaustible caress. With his sides he tasted the water, felt current flow, and with lidless eyes he saw before him the deep brown pool between the great buttress roots of an alder. He darted forward, silvery, into shadow. He had got free. He was home. The water ran timelessly from its clear spring. He lay on the sand of the pool's bottom, letting running water stronger than any spell of healing soothe his wound and with its coolness wash away the bleaker cold that had entered him. But as he rested, he felt and heard a shaking and trampling in the earth. Who walked now in his forest? Too weary to try to change form, he hid his gleaming trout body under the arch of the alder root and waited. Huge grey fingers groped in the water, roiling the sand. In the dimness above water, vague faces, blank eyes loomed and vanished, reappeared. Nets and hands groped, missed, missed again, then caught and lifted him writhing up into the air. He struggled to take back his own shape and could not. His own spell of homecoming bound him. He writhed in the net, gasping in the dry, bright, terrible air, drowning. The agony went on, and he knew nothing beyond it. After a long time, and little by little, he became aware that he was in his human form again. Some sharp, sour liquid was being forced down his throat. Time lapsed again, and he found himself sprawled face down on the dank floor of the vault. He was back in the power of his enemy, and though he could breathe again, he was not very far from death. The chill was all through him now, and the trolls, Vol's servants, must have crushed the fragile trout body, for when he moved his ribcage and one forearm stabbed with pain. Broken and without strength, he lay at the bottom of the well of night. There was no power in him to change shape. There was no way out but one. Lying there, motionless, almost but not quite beyond the reach of pain, Festin thought, "Why has he not killed me? Why does he keep me here alive? Why has he never been seen? With what eyes can he be seen? On what ground does he walk? He fears me, though I have no strength left. They say that all the wizards and men of power whom he has defeated live on, sealed in tombs like this, live on year after year trying to get free. But if one chose not to live..." So Festin made his choice. His last thought was, "If I am wrong, men will think I was a coward." But he did not linger on this thought. Turning his head a little to the side, he closed his eyes, took a last deep breath, and whispered the word of unbinding, which is only spoken once. This was not transformation. He was not changed. His body, the long legs and arms, the clever hands, the eyes that had liked to look on trees and streams, lay unchanged, only still, perfectly still and full of cold. But the walls were gone. The vaults built by magic were gone, and the rooms and towers and the forest and the sea and the sky of evening. They were all gone. And Festin went slowly down the far slope of the hill of being under new stars. In life he had had great power, so here he did not forget. Like a candle flame, he moved in the darkness of the wider land, and remembering, he called out his enemy's name.
"Vol!"
Called, unable to withstand, Vol came towards him, a thick, pale shape in the starlight. Festin approached, and the other cowered and screamed as if burnt. Festin followed where he fled, followed him close. A long way they went, over dry lava flows from the great extinct volcanoes rearing their cones against the unnamed stars, across the spurs of silent hills, through valleys of short black grass, past towns or down their unlit streets, between houses through whose windows no face looked. The stars hung in the sky, none set, none rose. There was no change here. No day would come. But they went on, Festin always driving the other before him, till they reached a place where once a river had run, very long ago. A river from the living lands. In the dry stream bed among boulders, a dead body lay, that of an old man, naked, flat eyes staring at the stars that are innocent of death.
"Enter it,"
Festin said. The Vol shadow whimpered, but Festin came closer. Vol cowered away, stooped, and entered in the open mouth of his own dead body. At once the corpse vanished. Unmarked, stainless, the dry boulders gleamed in starlight. Festin stood still a while, then slowly sat down among the great rocks to rest. To rest, not sleep, for he must keep guard here until Vol's body, sent back to its grave, had turned to dust, all evil power gone, scattered by the wind and washed seaward by the rain. He must keep watch over this place, where once death had found a way back into the other land. patient now, infinitely patient. Festin waited among the rocks where no river would ever run again, in the heart of the country which has no seacoast. The stars stood still above him, and as he watched them, slowly, very slowly, he began to forget the voice of streams and the sound of rain on the leaves of the forests of life.